amplifying diverse voices in the energy revolution. Here's your host, Amy Simpkins.
Welcome back to the Power Flow Podcast. I am Amy Simpkins, your host today, and with me, I have Diane Dandino, CEO of iPower Alliance. Diane is a serial entrepreneur and lifelong artist. She has had a passion for renewable energy since living in a passive solar home while going to art school in New Mexico. Her purpose in life is now focused on creating functional and beautiful integrated renewable energy, EV charging, and energy management solutions that allow her customers to focus on their business while achieving the highest return on investment possible. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Amy. Happy to be here.
Full disclosure to our guests, you know, sometimes I have guests who are like total and complete strangers to me. And then sometimes I have guests who are like friends and colleagues, and Diane is the latter. And so I'm extra excited, as if I'm not always excited about guests. But I want to go, this is random, but with that bio and you talk about functional and beautiful renewable energy, mm-hmm. I have to ask, are you a fan and reader of Vitruvius, the Roman architect?
Oh no, I need to read that.
That was one of the things that, like, it was one of those moments where Diane and I have always been kind of kindred spirits. We're alike in so many ways, like even like our like outside of work hobbies and things like that. We like to sing. We like to be on the water and paddling. And this is, if you'll allow me, I'm totally hijacking Diane's episode here. There's Vitruvius said in his Principles of Architecture, which is like the first known written treatise on architecture, that to be a good architecture, you have to have three qualities. You have to have utilitas, firmitas, and venestas. And utilitas means usefulness or functionality. Firmitas means like robustness or strength or ability to stand the test of time. And venestas means beauty. And it's one of my favorite principles. There's a great R. Buckminster Fuller quote, which is, when I'm working on solving a problem, I never think about beauty. But if I've gotten to the end and my solution is not beautiful, I know it's wrong. So that line in your bio, today, when I read it today, just jumped out at me as like, oh my gosh, we're such kindred spirits, Diane. So having said that, tell me a little bit about iPower Alliance, what you do, and what you're excited about right now.
Wow. Well, thank you. No, that's just awesome because, you know, as an artist, and a lot of what I painted for many years was Anasazi ruins and all the architecture of these beautiful ruins. And I just saw the beauty, and, you know, it's also part of my spiritual path, is like just being really connected to what I'm doing and what I'm building and creating. And so it's just a reflection over and over again. And so coming back around, like I actually was an artist and made a living as an artist for many years. And then, things changed, the world changed. And but also, I actually sold solar in the early 80s. And then the solar industry went away with the tax credits going away. And so I got into the software business. This is leading up to answering your question, but I got in the software industry. And I wound up selling and building software for the automotive and collision industry. I did that for 20 years. And I built a passive solar house, and I loved living with the sun. And actually, solar was like a hobby. I was reading it and studying it and was dreaming about building things. All the time I had a software company. Sold that company, moved to Colorado, tried to be an artist for a minute, didn't work. Then the tax credits came back. And the Amendment 37 in 2005 and 6 came into being. And I was like, well, this is an opportunity for me to go back to my passion and make a living. again, doing something that I cared about deeply, like bringing in business. And so getting into the solar industry, looking for always, how do I help my customers? And we started with residential, but I decided to go to commercial, and it was really about the economics of solar. I mean, people, even the greenest people, cared about the money part, really. So I was really like, how can we find every angle possible to make these projects financially viable? And also, I liked the look of solar, so I always thought it was beautiful. But then we started doing carports, and then I started going to car dealerships because I knew them. I understood the business, and I started having success selling solar to car dealerships. And the biggest part of that was, again, it was focusing on stacking every incentive I could find, every value to them I could find. And so we started winning projects because it met the financial thresholds. So after about 10, 12 years of this, I kind of like had a vision where I really saw opportunities to bring in solar and building demand management. This was a little bit pre-battery, but like how that was a big piece for helping solve the demand charge problem with solar, and started putting packages together. And where I was working, like, they weren't that interested. They just wanted to do solar. So I left and I started a solar company, kind of looked for a job, say, hey, I've got this idea. Will you hire me? And nobody would hire me except I get referrals. I started getting customers. So we started building solar and actually a hail canopy solution for the automotive industry, which has turned into actually one of our main verticals and our main solutions that stack not only multiple values for our customer, we're saving them money on tax credits, also return on investment with energy production, and on hail losses. So this has turned into a real big part of our business. And that's the big focus of iPower Alliance. It's not our only, because we have good years with lots of hail and several years without hail, and it's kind of quiet. But then commercial business that we're doing, we're bringing all these other values, and including batteries now, including EV chargers. It's like I still see this energy solutions need to be designed more holistically. And like, we got to think of this whole thing together. And so that's a big part of what we're trying to continue to do. How do we find multiple solutions, multiple problems to solve for a customer with and bring multiple value? I guess that's the answer.
Wow. First of all, thank you for sharing your story. There's so much richness in there, and I have so many questions. So we'll see. We'll see how we go here. First, I think very practically speaking, you mentioned EV charging right at the end, and I think it's fascinating kind of the niche that you're in a little bit. Not that you don't work on other things too, but you mm-hmm. know, having worked around automotive for so long in your career, and then now having such great relationship with car dealerships, you know, how do you see the EV revolution, the electric vehicle revolution, as changing? I want to say changing things in general, but like specifically around like your dealership clients, how is it changing the way they think about energy? Is it? Are you doing the thinking for them? Are they thinking about it? How is that? How is the introduction of electric vehicles changing things?
First of all, they're shocked at how it's affecting their utility bills. So first clients I talked to that were putting in chargers, like actually in North Dakota, and what's happened is the manufacturers have come in and said, hey, you want to keep selling our cars? You got to put in our charger. You got to put in EV chargers. That's because we're selling EVs. So, you know, it's kind of across the board, and it's actually kind of market related too. So in more progressive markets, the dealerships are generally, I'll do what makes sense. I'll sell what my customers want to buy. We'll invest if we have to, you know. So, but in some markets like North Dakota, where EV charging, EV selling, even EVs is still not as big of a market as other places. They still had to put this stuff in, and then they weren't told about demand charges. And I said, "Yeah, I charge one car. It cost me $1,900 that month." You know, it was like crazy. So. We spend a lot of time educating, well, first of all, doing analysis for our customers, like which utility they're in, what programs the utilities are offering, and then providing the best solution for them. So in one case, we put in a free wire charger that has a built-in battery because we could keep them under their $35 kilowatt demand limit. I have other places we're working with Xcel who puts in the infrastructure and their rates are reasonable. So there's so many pieces. So we are the ones that are actually helping them figure this out. I've gone in after the fact of customers who said, "Oh my gosh, these people have quoted me this and said that, like, that's a really bad program idea. Let me show you some options." And so that's how I've operated my whole career. I'm a consultative salesperson. I care that we try to solve the customer's problems the best possible way, and then we get to do work. That's how I see things.
Yeah, that's super interesting that the dealerships are being driven by the OEMs, the vehicle OEMs. Mm-hmm. I was at the Electrify America. One of the Electrify America shows, they do several, but the one in Austin last fall. And I talked to several vehicle OEMs and I was all like, you know, how do you talk to your, you know, potential clients about the impacts of charging, especially the economics of impacts? And to a company, they were all like, "Oh, we don't." And so it doesn't surprise me at all that they're not even talking to their dealerships about the impacts.
You know, the state of Colorado has been doing a pretty good job about educating their with the grant programs. Like, so there's a charge ahead grants, which will help a lot of dealerships apply. And they say, make sure, have you talked to your utility? Do you understand the demand charge issues? So they've been helping with that education. But really, it has been astonishing to me that I'm often coming in with other competitors and I'm the only one who's actually doing an analysis for them, showing them if you do one charge a day or three charges a day, I run through a whole financial model at this rate. And this is like helping them understand the impact so they're not surprised later and they can make a better decision. But no one else is doing it that I have discovered in my direct experience with my customers.
Yeah, it's one thing to implement new technology and be courageous enough to do that. But to implement new technology when you don't have the data to understand what it means. So I want to go back a little more toward the beginning of your story. I think you bring such a cool perspective being in solar deployment since the 80s, because you have been able to see the narrative arc of the solar story I feel fairly confident saying mature technology that it is today. Even though there's always more advances, we've got better cells, flexible cells, higher efficiencies. It's more inverter technology, la, 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 la. But still, I think, you know, for the years that solar has been in place, you know, you have gotten to see a lot of that arc. And so I guess my question for you is, well, I want to lead you and I'll give it away first. I want to lead you and say, where do you think batteries or energy storage in general are on the trajectory based on like your experience with solar. But I guess more generally, I shouldn't lead you to energy storage and say, you know, what are the other trends or technologies you're seeing out there? And you're like, "Oh, I remember how this went with solar." and you can kind of see where we're headed.
Yeah. Well, so early on, I lived in New Mexico in Albuquerque, and I was selling hot air systems and hot water systems. So thermal. And then I was aware of like the Sandia Labs and Los Alamos Labs were doing PV. And, you know, I was, again, that was my hobbyist self that was always studying that, but it wasn't really commercially viable. So early on, that we saw an existence of PV, but we weren't selling it yet. But I have to also say is that as soon as the tax credits went away, I got a job selling IBM PCs back in the day. So I think that there's more of a comparison to the computer industry. It's like back, you know, we saw PCs and people were starting to adopt them. And of course now it's 40 years later and it's just part of everyday life with everyone. Looking at battery technology and IoT as being the thing that's going to be more ubiquitous in the world. So what's happening right now, and it's interesting because we're in commercial solar, and commercial solar is not really growing. It's just continued to struggle. The economics for commercial solar is still trying to find enough value to stack to get a customer to want to install it. But, you know, utility scale and community solar, this is big projects are taking over PV. That's the direction of the generation side. But the part that I think is going to grow is going to be storage because of the additional electrification of the grid. As we're talking about adding all these EVs, there's a shortage of transformers. There's the cost of the infrastructure. Well, how do we start to deal with a problem of not just throwing more hardware or pipes of energy, but actually get localized storage and localized energy management? That I think is coming over the next several years. I'm probably going to be retiring before it's really in place, but I think that's where I see, you know, and then there is going to be some local distribution that'll help that, but that's where I see the growth, and that's where I see the utilities also focusing, like how are we going to get the power we need to where we need it when we need it without actually doing some load shifting.
Yeah, it's I think it's always shocking to site hosts, to clients, not just the, oh gosh, I didn't really realize how I was paying for power. And now I have all this power. I want all this power, and it's the bill is shocking, but also when the utility comes back and says, "I'm sorry, I don't have that power for you." Have you seen that happen in practice?
I haven't. We've been pretty, most of the projects we've been working on, the utilities come back and said, yes, we have it, but it's like my customers have been ahead of the curve. It's coming. It's, the next customer in line is not going to get it. So that's what's happening. But the bigger issue is like even getting transformers. They're a year out.
Absolutely.
We design for a year and then it takes a year to build things. That's what our current process is.
Well, what's interesting about that for me is that I think a lot of people in the general public and in the industry as well, even people who are in the industry and know what is possible, you know, think that this is solved science, that it's easy, and that like you can just plug stuff in and it works. And to an extent, that's true. But like you're saying, like the problem is the transformers. Like how much of the general public actually knows what a transformer is for and why you might need one? I mean, and let alone be able to say, oh gosh, like this is going to become a problem, you know, down the road. And so that's, I think that's the thing that I'm seeing too, is like, a belief that all these deployments are going to be very easy because we have the technology, we have the equipment, but actually putting it together in a way that makes it work electrically and on a communications level is sometimes challenging.
Yeah. Oh, it's a huge challenge. And yeah, most of, I've learned a lot. I'm learning more and more all the time, you know, from what we're dealing with. That's how I've learned everything. It's like, oh, let's go do this and then we'll learn about it.
Same, absolutely same. And one of my mentors in innovation always, I've said this multiple times on this podcast, but it's always worth saying again that the only way innovation happens is through, by doing projects. Like you have to go out, you can talk about the theory of it until you're blue in the face. We had a colleague who had called us to, you know, ask some questions, check his thinking. And, he's a research scientist and he said, well, a battery is a battery. And, you know, it's like, it's just a, you know, it's a black box and you plug it in and does what it does. And it's like, oh, wow. Like, you know, if you've, that's spoken like someone who's never actually tried to hook up a battery and do a project with it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
So talking about challenges here, I'm curious, you know, you've been, I think we've had a really good conversation about some of the general trends that you're seeing. And so with that queued up, like, what are the biggest challenges that are coming up? I mean, it might be something we've already talked about. That's okay. But, you know, what haven't we covered yet that are maybe some of the known unknowns that you see coming up that are keeping us from this all electric, clean energy future?
Well, it's, again, it's all about the economics. Bottom line, like who cares and who's paying for it? And it's what's the cost of the alternative? So in the conversations with the utilities, like they're driving a lot of generation. And, you know, I appreciate Xcel being a leader in more clean, renewable energy for sure. And so, but then like they're, you know, I think we're in a world that we don't want to leave this all to just the utilities. It is like, how do we actually do an all of the above solution? But they control the rate structures between the PUC and how they run their businesses. And so what happens then in the marketplace is that it's just always not getting better. And so let's, for example, in California, the, you know, NEM 3, it's like net metering's gone. Well, the industry is changing. It's, Colorado still has net metering. We don't know for how long. That's a big driver for the success of solar. And then the value of storage has not really been identified by everybody. Like, how do we actually make the economics of adding storage work? I did, you're familiar with a project I did for Ehrlich Toyota, which is now McDonald Toyota up in Greeley. Back when I met the owner, Scott, he had a lot of power outages. It was in an area of Xcel territory that was just not very reliable power-wise. And he was, they were having like almost one a month. And, you know, people, if the power was off for more than 5 minutes, all their customers left and all their employees left. And all of a sudden he lost a day of business, which we could actually add up the value of that. So we installed at the time the largest behind the meter battery in Xcel territory, plus a 368 kilowatt solar carport and building controls and And so it has been a phenomenal project, and it made a lot of money for him, and it saved them a lot of money on multiple levels. It's right now, generally, the utilities are reliable enough that people don't have a need for resiliency or a value of resiliency. So that's not a economic driver of a battery. And so then for peak shaving and demand savings, the economics just aren't making them work enough for the current models. So the question is, going forward, is that as the utilities are looking at the value of them not having to install more infrastructure, the value of them being able to talk to these batteries, and they are putting out some RFQs to look at projects to design these. How do we figure out the value of that so we can fund the installation of these batteries? But we're not there yet. The economics of all this isn't there. So then right now the marketplace is, it's at least in Excel territory, and a lot of the areas I'm working in, we're not installing batteries yet because of that.
So I hear kind of two issues there. I hear the issue of needing the economic justification at all and not being able to sustain it completely on a rate tariff basis, not completely on a resilient backup power basis. You know, sometimes maybe you said earlier, you know, non-wires alternatives to cost of utility upgrades. You know, that those could be, but that hasn't all gelled together yet. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. I think it's still in the, we're actually in Lyons. I'm going to be installing a EV battery-based EV charger because Lyons has demand charges for commercial they're putting in place. So I ran the analysis. If we put in a standard 200 kW EV charger, and this is actually a NEVI site, so it'd been four of those. The town of Lyons or the customer would have lost $50,000 a year in charging revenue because of the rate structure. So we looked at the battery compared to battery solution, and we're actually going to put in a battery that's going to be charged at a 50 kilowatt speed and deliver at 150 kilowatts.
Yeah. So awesome. So there it is.
This is it. This particular scenario, the economics were there, and the company, which is called eCamion or Joule out of Canada, is owning the project, and they are putting it in because they want to get their technology into the marketplace. So again, the economics of this is still on the investment level.
Right. Very nascent. So the other thing then, so we have the economic non-gelling problem over here. And then the other thing I heard was this sort of tension, and believe me, I feel it too, the tension between what happens at utility scale deployment and what happens behind the meter, particularly around commercial and industrial sector, because you and I work mostly in the commercial sector. So, you know, right. Residential is a little bit of an animal on its own, but like, mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting question. I definitely see also that it's an interesting question of like, does utility scale generation and storage fix all of the problems? Is there a value in behind the meter? You know, yes to everything, everywhere, all at once. You know, but how do you see that playing out in the future in terms of the breakdown? It seems like you're making an argument that there are valuable features of behind the meter systems, that not everything should be left at that large, more centralized utility scale.
Right. Well, one of the biggest differences is that the utility scale, it's still down the wire, so you don't have any resilience. Mm-hmm. So the question of any resilience needs to be behind the meter, for sure. So you need to be able to have a battery in storage or generation or whatever, generator, something has to be on site. So I still think that critical loads or critical businesses, like right now, hospitals and, you know, they have generators for sure. And, you know, so there's the value for battery over generator for speed of transit for and things like that. But so that's valuable. And then also, again, what kind of loads are going to be installed at these sites? So if you are talking about putting, let's say it's a fleet of buses, it's much better to have the batteries right there than down the road or, you know, far away. So again, it's, you can utilize and manage that battery for that resource with those loads. And so what I'm hearing, and just being at the COSA conference this past few days and talking to Xcel, you know, they are, even in the other utilities, so the bigger issue right now, I think, is existence of the demand management software on their side to be able to talk to off, you know, unsighted like batteries and be able to communicate in addition, like they're controlling like the saver switch, you know, there's different ways that they're controlling HVAC units and other kinds of loads. They could communicate to EV chargers, making sure they're throttled if need be. They could talk to batteries, but the software exists, but it is not implemented. So I think that that's the next piece, is that the utilities need to have this software that they can then help manage from their side, a customer relationship that says, yes, I'll, if you'll let me manage your battery, then I will pay you something. But that infrastructure is not there. It's spotty. Some have it, some don't. And I think that everybody's going through a big process right now. So that's what I think is we're kind of waiting for.
We're like the caterpillar and the goo before we become a butterfly. Like it's all, everything's right. In process. So the commonality that I hear here, and I think I would love to hear your thoughts on holistic thinking. You know, you talked about holistic thinking at the beginning when you talked about even just approaching a site in a holistic way and saying, look, we can't just think about your on-site generation in a vacuum. We have to think about the way your building is consuming loads. We have to think about the vehicles you're going to electrify. And when we think about it in a holistic way, then we can get you a solution that works. And so to me, the things you're saying about these different piece parts of the economic justification for distributed energy, and also this tension between what happens at the utility side versus behind the meter, requires some holistic thinking. So I wonder if you could comment, you know, how do we go about thinking holistically about these super big topics that feel overwhelming?
Yeah.
I know you have the answer, Diane. You're the one. Like right now, I know we're going to solve everyone's problems right now.
Okay.
No pressure. No pressure.
So that is actually what I'm doing almost one at a time, because it's like there is no blanket answer. I mean, from where I live, there are five different utilities within an hour of me. And that means there are five different answers to that question. And then every business entity has a different set of priorities. The one thing that's really nice about working with vertical markets, and I learned this early in my career, is that you can get really good at a vertical market if you spend your time with it. I was working at a computer store. One day I'm selling to a teacher, the next the attorney, and the next was somebody else. Like, I can't be good at any of this. So I decided to get into the automotive industry. I became really good at that. And so now when we're focusing on, you know, we're good at commercial, we're really good at automotive. And I know all the nuances in the automotive side, I think. I'm still learning. But the question of every utility has a different strategy and rates and even plans for the near future. And a specific feasibility and study has to be done on any site, every site, on all the things they want. So they need EV charging. Are we putting in a separate transformer or not? On a different meter with a different rate? Or is it going on the same meter, same rate? Do we need to add infrastructure to that building? Well, we have to look at the existing infrastructure on the building. Do they have enough existing amps in their switchgear? There's, and then looking at the solar opportunity, and then how large can we build? Are we going to add carports because they have opportunity for value for shade or coverage? There's all of these different things. And so as my CEO, Richard, says, Diane, I really love what you're doing because you don't do it because it's easy. You do it because it's hard. And it is hard to do this, but that's why, but the hard work needs to get done.
Right.
Now, once we can, we do have some replicable models that we are doing, but as I mentioned, like the utilities are saying, yeah, well, we're changing this, we're changing that. So there's still more to come, but there's lots people can do right now, and especially like they have to install EV chargers, then let's talk now and let's start doing the analysis for you. So, you know, I wish I could answer the question, but the answer is it is possible to figure this stuff out if we are allowed to get the data we need, the information, if we have customers who are willing to work with us so we can help them figure it out. And then we can come back with recommendations to provide them the best, what I call it, operational and financial resilience.
Awesome. So think holistically, one project at a time.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Last question. I want to hear about beauty, and I want to hear about what makes a beautiful distributed energy solution?
So, you know, standard rooftop, and I mean, I like how solar works, so I think it's beautiful. But I think that for me, just we've partnered with a company called VPS, it's Vehicle Protection Systems, and they are the leading hail protection provider for the automotive industry. And there are these fabric canopies, a steel and fabric canopies, and we work together to design the solar integrated solution with them. And so we've installed that at Stapp Toyota and Christopher's Dodge and Mini and BMW of Loveland. And now we've got about seven or eight more we're building right now. That I think they're absolutely beautiful. Some of the car dealerships prefer to see just cars and not have any coverage over them. But the reality is that we need to cover cars in Colorado. So if you're going to cover cars, I believe what we put together is really beautiful. And VPS, like they'll do, they do powder coated steel columns that, and then we have different colored fabric, and then our solar is on top, and the design is beautifully designed. It is just beautiful. Looks beautiful aesthetically. That's what I'm trying to say. Aesthetically designed to be beautiful, and because it's part of their showroom. And so that's how I see it.
I was going to say on the previous episode, we talked about the buying experience, and that like how much packaging has become important to us as a part of the shopping, buying, having experience to open the box, you know, and be impressed by the way. And I think car buying is almost like the ultimate. It's in some ways, you know, it's only been around for a little over 100 years, but it still feels like part of the American dream or part of the American ethos to like when you go to buy a car. So I can only imagine that, you know, having a beautiful buying experience where you don't get to open the box on a car, but you do get to walk on the lot if you're buying a new car. And to me, it does feel like it's an important part of the experience. And if you're going to spend that kind of money to go through the new buying new experience, like over buying used or something like that, you know, you do want to have that kind of treatment and that kind of beauty surrounding you.
Yeah. When we built STAP Toyota's project, it's cool to walk under the canopies, and found out their customers hang out longer. They look longer. They don't just run in and out. The cars are comfortable to get in. You know, so there's just all these additional benefits that were nice to have to bring to our customers. It's like, for me, it brings a beautiful solution. It's functional. It's practical. It was cost effective. And it's beautiful.
That's amazing. Diane, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we could probably go on and on, but we're just about at the end of our time here. So if people wanted to get in touch with iPower Alliance and connect with your work, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, our website is iPowerAlliance.com. So that's the best place, I think, to see what some photos of what I've been talking about and connect with us there.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your wisdom today.
You are welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to have this really fun conversation. Always great to visit with you.
And thanks to you, listeners, for being with us today on PowerFlow. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and have some new ideas sparking about holistic thinking and technologically beautiful systems. And we'll see you next time here at the whiteboard.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the PowerFlow podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share the episode with other innovators, leave us a positive review, and subscribe to PowerFlow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes for this episode, more great conversations, PowerFlow merchandise, and more at powerflowpodcast.com. PowerFlow is hosted by Amy Simpkins, produced by Devin Shanchek, and managed by Laura Novak. See you next time here at the whiteboard.